your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Sunday morning wake-up call here on WNRN. My name is Pete Ronayne, sitting in for Rick Moore, who gets to spend some extra time with his family this weekend. Thanks to Scott Buchanan for bringing us through Bluegrass Sunday morning this morning. We get to turn our attention to some large questions today as you two an elevation fade. In the background, I'm joined in the studio this morning by Professor Jonathan Haidt, who's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He is the author of this fascinating book, The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. He's also co-editor of Flourishing's Positive Psychology and the Life Well Lived. John, welcome to the show.
Morning, glad to be here.
There you go. Let me turn your mic on to get us started. That's a little bit helpful. We've got a lot of ground to cover, and I'm glad that we have an hour to do it, sitting down with your book and going over just the huge range of issues. I mean, it's an ambitious project, to be sure, and this combination of modern concepts of science and psychology, et cetera, married to philosophy. So what would be really interesting, I think, to make this accessible to our listeners and certainly to welcome them to call in, because no doubt you'll have lots of questions for Professor Haidt at 979-0919. If you're further out in the listening area, 1-877-967-6762. This issue of positive psychology, first off, just to kind of get us anchored, because when I sat down with the book, honestly, I'd never heard of positive psychology. Could you give us some background on what that is exactly and how it's distinct from psychology in general?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, psychologists have been working on a lot of problems for a long time, and most of us, when we get into this field, we say, well, I want to make the world a better place. I want to work on racism or prejudice or war or drug addiction, depression. So we've got lots of stuff to say about all the problems of life. But most people are actually doing pretty well. Most people are not mentally ill. Most people are not suffering too badly. But they want to get more out of life. They want to know what they can do. And when they go to the bookstore, there's nothing there for them written by a scientist. It's all pop psych. It's all Deepak Chopra and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1998 or so, Martin Seligman, the president of the American Psychological Association, said, you know, enough of this. We need to start studying what really matters to people. We need to start studying the conditions of human well-being and happiness and courage and virtues. So he sort of single-handedly turned the ship of psychology and launched a new area of research into what makes life worth living.
So as recent as the 90s, as the birth of positive psychology as a sort of sub-discipline within psychology.
That's right. It's grown amazingly fast. Yes.
I'm sure. And the idea, again, as you mentioned, is so much of other psychology is focused on kind of the aberrance or obviously the opposite, the negative. So let's see what works well with people and what makes them tick in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Very good. And from you personally, why write this book? What sort of got you started? I mean, it's an ambitious project, which we'll get into in more details. But how did you decide, here's what I want to explore, you know, personally and spend, you know, it takes a couple of years at least to write a book. And this one is full of all sorts of content from a range of disciplines, really. What was the genesis of this project for you?
Well, I teach Psych 101 at UVA. I teach the big lecture class with 350 students, and I try to cover the whole field of psychology in about 22 lectures. And I guess each of us have certain things that really turn us on, things that we really enjoy doing. And for me, that's always been just making connections across fields, just figuring out how stuff works. So while I was teaching Psych 101, when I would try to illustrate principles for the students and try to link it to things that were going on in their lives, I found myself quoting Jefferson and Shakespeare and
Jefferson
Buddha.
At UVA?
I find
that hard to believe.
Yeah. Oh, Jefferson. Well, it's actually my contract. I have to cite him five times a year or I don't get promoted. So anyway, I put up all these quotes from the ancients, and I just began wondering, well, you know, how many of these are there? And I just started collecting them. And especially it was at a time when I was wondering whether or not I'd get tenure. I was thinking, well, you know what? If I don't get tenure, I'm just going to write this book.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where I got the idea. And then, well, I did get tenure. a couple years later, I decided, what the heck? Let me just write this book. I've always wanted to do it.
Uh-huh. So it was also already sort of informing your classroom teaching. And you were sensing the positive reaction from the students. And so why not capture it in text?
Yeah, that's right, because there's something really ennobling and enriching when you hear an idea expressed beautifully, and secondly, when it's expressed by somebody with some sort of authority.
Right, some clout or background or from the Pantheon. Mm-hmm. Or yeah.
That's exactly. So, you know, I could say all kinds of psychological principles straight out to my class, but somehow it just feels better. It's more uplifting. It's more memorable if it's couched in terms of an aphorism from a famous figure.
Mm-hmm. And just from a almost a publishing perspective, I don't want to go too far down this road, but your book is published by Basic. Mm-hmm. What kind of reception did you get when you went out with the project? You have a book proposal in hand about happiness and marrying contemporary science and the wisdom of the ancients. Just curious for just a few minutes, how did that go?
The publishing world is an interesting world and very different from the academic world. I never thought of this as a book on happiness. The original title was 12 Great Truths, Insights mm-hmm. into Mind and Heart from Ancient Cultures and Modern Psychology. And then as I began running out of time in writing the book, it actually went down to 10 Great Truths. I just kind of was running out of time. But when the publishers got a hold of it, a lot of people don't know this, but authors do not get to make up their titles or their covers. That mm-hmm. is a marketing decision, and so we have no control. So Basic made up the title, The Happiness Hypothesis, and they stuck a big smiley face on the cover, and they couldn't get it out of their heads that this was about more than happiness. So everything they did, all their promotional materials have been about happiness, get happy. And it really is irritating to me.
And that tone is irritating too, isn't it? People...
It is.
Okay, but and now, sadly, I am going to transition now into happiness now that you've mentioned it. But the book is about more, as you mentioned, morality and virtues and religion, and I also want to get into applications later. How do we operationalize this, both as individuals and in a collective sort of way? But let's talk about happiness. What is happiness exactly?
Well, there are two main approaches. In psychology, most people focus on what do you feel inside, because it doesn't really make sense to say that somebody's happy if they don't know it or they don't feel it. So most of the research is on what are the conditions that lead us to feel good, feel positive, feel optimistic. But what I learned in doing all the historical research is that there's a much bigger perspective where you look at the conditions of a life that you would be pleased or proud to lead. The Greeks said you can't tell if a man is happy until after he's dead, because their conception of happiness wasn't, you know, yay, I feel good. Mm-hmm. It was that this is an admirable life, a life worth having. So what my book is really about is what do we know about the conditions that lead to a good life, a flourishing life, a happy life in that broader sense.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not just walking around kind of with a smile on your face and being kind of Pollyanna. There's a lot more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And early on in the book, I found a fascinating chapter about almost kind of the genetics of happiness. You spend a good amount of time on the nature versus nurture part of our hardwiring and our individual proclivities towards happiness. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Sure, because this is the big discovery in happiness research, is that your average level of happiness, like just about everything else about you, is highly heritable. What that means is that you inherited certain genes, those genes made your brain, and the structure of your brain is like a filter that you use to interpret the whole world. So some people are born, you know, with a filter that's always looking for threats,
mm-hmm.
and they're very good at detecting threats. And, you know, as Mark Twain said, my life has been filled with terrible disasters and horrible things that never happened. and other people are born with rose-colored glasses. They see opportunities. And if you had an identical twin and you were separated at birth and mm-hmm. raised differently, you would be about as happy as your twin, because it's not much affected by your early childhood. A little bit.
So they've shared that genetic coding or genetic exactly. predisposition towards either glass full or glass
exactly.
Half empty. And
that's right. So they end up with very similar filters. So in the late 90s, when all this work on behavioral genetics was coming out, you know, and it turned out everything is heritable, whether you like jazz versus rock. You know, if you have an identical twin, they'll have similar musical preferences. Not exactly, but, you know, more than random.
And the science shows sort of how much. I mean, we're always trying to strike a balance between the nature and nurture.
Right.
From your perspective and your research, mm-hmm. Yeah, how much of my sort of happiness quotient have I inherited?
It's hard to quantify, to say what these numbers mean, but happiness and IQ are two of the most heritable things that we know of. I mean, average happiness levels averaged over months. One way to say it is that between 50 to 70% of the variance between people is due to their genes.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is due to various other factors, including environment.
Yeah, so even at 50%, we're talking about, it's a huge amount.
That's right.
Which I guess that could make you happy, or it could be somewhat distressing if you're kind of hardwired.
It depends on your filter. If you're pre-wired to see threats, boy, you're going to see that as a threat.
You're listening to the Wake Up Call on 91.9 WNRN. I'm Pete Ronayne, sitting in for Rick Moore, and my guest is Professor Jonathan Haidt from UVA. We're talking about his book and research on the happiness hypothesis. If you'd like to chime in, ask a question to John, 979-0919 or 1-877-967-6762. If I could stick with the genetics talk for just a second, you also back that up, or go back and talk about that we're animals in many ways, and so some of that hardwiring comes even earlier in terms of, and you mentioned the ideas of threat. Response to threat versus response to positive things. What about our sort of evolutionary nature has led us to have a certain happiness quotient or not?
Yeah, our personalities are products of evolution. Our minds are products of evolution, and the variance among people is also a product of evolution. So you can see this in other animals. You know, most people out there either have a dog or have had dogs. And boy, do dogs have personalities. And different breeds have personalities.
True.
And, you know, and you can look at it the same way. They've got filters. Some dogs are always seeing threats. Other dogs say, gee, you know, there's something. I want to go lick it or hump it. You know, so, you know, dogs have personalities and so do we. But I don't want to leave listeners with the thought that everything is sort of fixed by the genes. I just want to finish up on after that big discovery, then people started getting all fatalistic. But then, and this is where positive psychology comes in, we've discovered that, you know, even with that 50% variance that's fixed, fixed by your genes, there's a lot to play with. And there actually are a lot of things you can do to raise your daily happiness level. And that's what a few of the chapters in my book are about.
Absolutely. And in many ways, the genetic part and how much is your predisposition, I wouldn't say that it's lost in the rest of the book, but the rest of the book does move on to talk about taking ownership of this and awareness. So I think a good transition is your... a central metaphor or that you organize a lot of the book around, which is the riding the elephant. Could you explain to me what the riding the elephant is?
Yeah. You know, we can't really think about complicated things without a metaphor, and the mind is about as complex as anything gets, and so we need a good metaphor. And historically, people take their metaphors from the dominant technology of the day. So, you know, for Freud, the mind's a steam engine. For the behaviorists, the mind's a telephone switchboard. For most of us today, the mind is a computer. But that's not actually a very good metaphor, because that implies that there's a CPU, there's some central control system, and there's memory and all that sort of stuff. But I don't know about you, but the way that I live my life, I plan everything out, I think about what to do, and then I just sort of watch in horror as I don't do it. So what I learned, not just from my own life, but from really what was going on in social psychology in the 90s, is to see the mind as divided into parts that sometimes conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Freud said this, although now we know that his ideas of the unconscious were sort of too dark and strange. Really, the unconscious just refers to the fact that almost everything your brain does has to happen unconsciously, because you can only really be aware of one or two things at a time.
Right. We couldn't consciously think about everything that we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like the listeners can't see, but I'm moving my hand as I'm talking to you. I couldn't possibly consciously think, okay, move my hand this way, move it this way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be instantaneous and, as you mentioned, unconscious.
That's right. And even picking words, the words just kind of come to you somehow by some automatic process. So what we're realizing in psychology is that almost all of the mind is these automatic associative processes. And then, in addition, we human beings, maybe 100,000 to 500,000 years ago, developed language. We don't really know when. So we have this additional way of thinking. We can think in words. We can plan things out. But what you have to realize is that this consciousness, this verbal consciousness, is not really in control. In fact, for the most part, a lot of studies show that this verbal consciousness is kind of like Howard Cosell providing a running commentary on what has already happened down on the field. Yeah, I guess that shows how old I am from the 70s and 80s. But we pay so much attention to what's in our consciousness, but actually it's not really all that important. So the metaphor that I use in the book is that we are like a rider on the back of an elephant.
Right.
And if the rider and the elephant are really well integrated, if the rider has trained the elephant well, then he can direct him. But for the most part, if the elephant suddenly gets the urge to do something, he's going to do it because he's a lot stronger than the rider.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really the secret to psychological growth and to flourishing, is to understand your limitations of control and to gradually work on training the elephant to get better integration between your conscious and unconscious.
And choosing the elephant is indicative of the size and the power of that unconscious versus mm-hmm. that relatively small rider that represents, we're going to call it rationality mm-hmm. or logic, or as you mentioned, you know, you've planned out your day, what you're going to do, and that's the rational side. But then the elephant kicks in, you don't get mm-hmm. any of that done.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, sure, I could have picked a horse. That would be the standard metaphor. But I really wanted to sort of crank up the disparity.
Yeah, absolutely. How much of this, when I was reading that particular portion, what came to mind was a little bit of, I don't know if you've read it, Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, mm-hmm. Which is the sort of that power of not thinking or
absolutely.
Whatever. Are you guys talking about similar things? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Gladwell is reviewing a lot of research done in social psychology, including some by my colleagues Tim Wilson and Brian Nozick.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Gladwell is reviewing all this work that also motivated me in the 90s to this view. And there's a lot. It's an important point that there's a lot of wisdom in the elephant. It's not like the elephant is this stupid animal and the rider is all the brains. The elephant is really, really smart at what it's good at,
mm-hmm.
and the rider is really bad at most things, but you know, very good at certain other things. And so, you know, Gladwell's right on target in saying that the elephant has a lot of wisdom. Now, I don't think he tells us enough about when we should distrust it. Now, you don't want to basically base foreign policy on gut instincts,
mm-hmm.
for example. I mean, there's a lot of things where you really do need to reason things out and weigh costs and benefits.
Right. All right, very good. Let's see. It is 11:20. You're listening to the Wake Up Call on WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And today's programming is also being supported by Wild Grains and American Grill, serving contemporary and nostalgic American food in a casual dining atmosphere. Wild Grains is open for lunch and for dinner 7 days a week, and for brunch 11:30 till 2 in the north wing of the Barracks Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville. The Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Showers and thunderstorms this morning. Showers with possibly heavy rainfall today. High of 80 to 85. Chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight. Low of 60 to 65. Then cloudy. Chance of showers and thunderstorms again tomorrow with high of 75 to 80. Right now in the valley, it's mostly cloudy and 75. Rain and 69 in Lynchburg. Cloudy and 79 in Lynchburg and here in Richmond, excuse me, and here in Charlottesville, 73 and scattered rain. With the wake-up call at WNRN, I'm Pete Ronayne sitting in for the vacationing Rick Moore, and I'm joined by Professor Jonathan Haidt from UVA, and we're talking about his fascinating book and research on the happiness hypothesis. In the fifth chapter of the book, you actually have a formula for happiness. You mentioned a formula for happiness, and I want to talk about your ideas of taming the elephant that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. But we do, in fact, have a call, so let's see here. Spencer, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead, you're online.
Hi, Jonathan. I just have a comment and an observation that we seem to understand when you have the blues, but you don't sometimes realize that you're happy until afterwards.
Well, in general, when people are depressed, they think that life is hopeless. They think that that they're terrible, and they think it's never going to change. So, you know, emotions are really, really compelling when we have them. So I think most people feel that they're miserable and can't see it changing. Now, what do you mean when you say when you have the blues, sometimes you realize afterwards that you were actually happy?
Well, if you're unhappy, you can definitely feel it. But sometimes it seems though when you're happy, it is just normal, and that's the way you should feel. And you don't necessarily capture that emotion until you see it in retrospect, perhaps.
Hmm. Well, I would agree that a lot of our lives we live in retrospect. I mean, we enjoy each moment for a moment while it's happening, and then you know for decades afterwards. So there's all kinds of interesting complexities in terms of, you know, looking back and looking forward on our happiness.
Thanks for the call, Spencer. And I think that he actually gets us into an interesting issue that I want to follow up with you on anyhow. And that's this issue of taking ownership a little bit and talking about how much happiness is in the mind. That the mind, we can sort of, I don't want to say control, and you can correct my language usage, but it's the active part of your book, really. Can you talk a little bit about, first, though, the happiness formula that you elaborate on, and then we'll move into some other bits.
Mm-hmm, sure. So, yeah, the happiness formula is that your happiness at any given moment is a product of your set point, and that's the genetic thing we were talking about before, mm-hmm. plus the conditions of your life, plus certain voluntary activities that you can do. Now, conditions, you know, people have always thought, oh, well, you know, if I get the conditions, that's what makes me happy or sad. And, you know, if I'm rich and healthy and married or something or have a girlfriend or boyfriend, then I'll be happy. It turns out that the conditions matter a lot less than we thought, but there are a few that matter, especially about relationships. The actions really in the voluntary activities, that's what's been such a cool discovery in positive psychology, that there's some really simple things that you can do on a daily basis that are going to raise your actual experience of happiness. Things like knowing what your strengths are and then arranging your days that you get to use them. Things like there's this amazing exercise. You just, at the end of each evening, list three things that went well that day mm-hmm. and why they went well. And if you do that each night, pretty soon during the day, you're noticing these things because you think, all right, I got to write this thing down tonight. Oh, good, there's one. All right,
you're retraining your mind. Even if your predisposition is maybe to see some of the more negatives, you're working on actively kind of retraining and reconditioning yourself to notice the positive.
Exactly, exactly. The Buddhists really were the masters of mental retraining, and they developed over thousands of years brilliant methods of getting us to stop being so attached, stop worrying so much. So this is, you know, in a sense, a kind of a Buddhist technology, but with a kind of a Western spin of, mm-hmm. you know, oh, things are actually really good, and you know, I'm not such a bad person, and let me be more aware of the evidence. Because what we now know about depression is that people who are prone to depression or who are depressed have this pessimistic explanatory style where when something good happens, they explain it away. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, that was a mistake or an accident.
Yeah, it was random and yeah. it's not going to happen mm-hmm. again.
That's right. So some very simple, you know, retraining exercises, especially for those who are, you know, who are prone to depression, anxiety, who are on the lower half of the happiness distribution. It turns out this simple exercise is as effective as Prozac mm-hmm. in raising their mood over a few months.
Right, and you mentioned in the book sort of the three ways to change your effective mm-hmm. style or approach. And one was meditation, which you just mm-hmm. alluded to with the Buddhist. The second is cognitive therapy, which you might speak about. And then I do have a couple of questions about Prozac
oh, yeah.
and the pharmacological approach to this. So what about cognitive therapy? What is that exactly versus sort of psychotherapy?
Right. You know, psychotherapy, there's so many different kinds, but it's all about, let's talk about our feelings and then our childhood and what caused them and things like that. And, you know, all forms of psychotherapy work better than placebo. I mean, it's useful to talk about issues, you know, about problems. But for most mental disorders and really for most mental health issues, it turns out to be much more effective to just retrain your mind, just change the way you think. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a set of techniques where you learn the mental distortions that you commonly make. It's like you learn to catalog your stupidities, the dumb things that you say to yourself about yourself, the criticisms that you make, all those sorts of things. You learn to catalog them and recognize them. And then as soon as you do them, you have a name for it. You say, oh, there's jumping to conclusion. Oh, that's the fortune teller error or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you learn to retrain and to think different thoughts, and that breaks the cycle. And you actually get happy, you get lifted out of your depression or anxiety, or, you know, it works for eating disorder, it works for all sorts of things. And it tends to work about as well as Prozac. Now, it's a lot easier to do that than it is to do meditation. Meditation works, but boy, is it hard.
So to really get into it, not just sitting quietly, but to really...
Have you ever tried sitting quietly? It's hard.
Very hard for me, actually.
Yeah, I teach a positive psychology class at UVA where the assignment is students have to pick a change. They have to make themselves a better person during the semester and then prove it. And you know, a lot of them try meditation to change their mental habits, and it works somewhat, but most of them can't stick with it. It's really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Cognitive therapy is much, much easier. And then easiest of all is Prozac. Absolutely.
Right? So why not take a pill mm-hmm. that can accomplish this without the hard work of retraining your mind and mentally cataloging? And isn't that the American way, really?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. Why not? No, I in the book, I do come across as fairly pro-Prozac. And when I say Prozac, I mean the SSRIs, all, you know, Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, they're pretty much all the same with some just minor variations.
With those commercials that you're not quite sure what they're advertising, but it's somebody running through a sunny field, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk about in the book, you tried it out yourself,
yeah, yeah.
Correct?
Yep, yeah. I tried it twice, yeah. So, you know, I'm sort of right in the middle of the distribution. I wasn't born to be happy or sad or anxious. I'm right in the middle. Yeah, Prozac certainly works well for people who are depressed. You know, part of it is a placebo effect, but we know, you know, look, Prozac works on dogs, actually. So we know it's not
all
placebo.
Yeah, there is Prozac for dogs,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, Prozac is really, you know, designed for people who are depressed. But the interesting discovery is that for people who are anywhere in the bottom half of the distribution, it kind of stops them from ruminating and criticizing. It helps them get over, you know, so you say something stupid, you make a mistake. And I don't know if you're like me, but, you know, you kick yourself about it for hours afterwards, maybe for days.
Mm-hmm.
And with Prozac, at least when I took it, you know, once the effect kicks in 4 or 5 weeks later, you know, I would do something dumb. And then right afterwards, I would just say, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that. But OK, what's next?
And then you had a specific you noticed a very positive bounce from the Prozac.
Oh, yeah.
You had a specific reason for not taking it anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, it's well, I took Paxil first. And Paxil has a little bit of another neurotransmitter that it affects. So Paxil just destroyed my ability to recall things. So I would greet people. You know, I felt like I was kind of cut off from my past a bit. And I would greet people and say, oh, hi. You, how you doing? So it was very embarrassing. And I realized, well, okay, I'm a professor at UVA. And I kind of need my memory more than I need peace of mind.
Yeah, the professional requirements are
unfortunately, yeah.
But what about the criticism, though, John, that this is almost the typically American way?
Yes.
And that in essence, it's not the way to go. Like, for example, look at Ritalin. I mean, it's another, drug, not the same issue, but, what is it? Almost 1 in 8 children I read are on Ritalin, and the United States is 5% of the world's population, and we consume 85% of the drug. I mean, why wouldn't this fall into the same kind of distribution?
Well, I guess that is the American way. You probably got the same stats with oil.
Yeah.
If you can do cognitive therapy is preferable to Prozac for almost everything in that it teaches you, it retrains you, and so it stays with you forever. Prozac, you get the benefits. Once you stop taking it, you lose the benefits. So, you know, I definitely would endorse cognitive therapy over Prozac. But as to the idea that Prozac is overprescribed, which a lot of people seem to think, I have mixed views on that. First of all, there are a lot of people who are just set to the low side, and they can do therapy, they can do whatever they want. They can make some progress. But it's not like these people have some real problem that they have to deal with or get to the heart of the matter. Their brain is set differently. It's set differently from most other people's. It's like they were born with bad vision.
That hardwiring you were talking about earlier.
It's a
physical condition, right?
Exactly. So, you know, like if you're born with bad eyes, should you get LASIK surgery or is that cheating?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course you should. and, you know, similarly, if you're born, with a set point set very low, then for those sorts of people, you know, of course they should try to do without it, but it's worth a 6-week experiment. It can transform their lives. Now, I've got to add the caveat that there is this association with suicide, which is really complicated and sort of philosophically very interesting because it is definitely true. Prozac kind of shakes things up there in your head. And it's definitely true that a number of people, dozens, maybe hundreds, have committed suicide when if they hadn't been on Prozac, they would not have committed suicide.
Hmm.
So that's really important to know, and that's horrible. But here's the paradox. Prozac is so effective at relieving depression that the suicide rate in the United States has gone down dramatically since it started.
Since its introduction.
That's right. So Prozac has saved a lot of lives, and it's also cost a few lives.
Interesting.
Now, so, boy, is that a conundrum, because it saved a lot more than it's cost.
It is. You're listening to The Wake Up Call on 919-WNRN. And additional support, or support today, is coming from 456.com. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, it's 456.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. If you'd like to call up and ask a question of our guest, Professor Jonathan Haidt, talking about the happiness hypothesis, 979-0919 or 1-877-967-6762. Question I maybe should have asked earlier, how do we measure happiness? We're talking a lot about happiness and doing X is going to make you happier, and you have some interesting information there about, you know, frankly, that wealth doesn't necessarily make you happier, kind of max out at a certain level, and you talk about lottery winners and et cetera. How do we measure happiness? Because it's very self-referential. I'm going to tell you I feel happy or not. How do we objectively gauge whether I'm happier than I was before?
Yeah, you know, you'd think there's all kinds of problems and difficulties. You'd think it'd be a hard thing to measure, but it turns out if you just ask people, you know, on a 1 to 7 scale, how you doing? Well, it's a little more complicated than that. But you give, you know, a questionnaire with 7 questions, each answer on a 7-point scale called the Satisfaction with Life Scale, developed by Ed Diener at the University of Illinois. This turns out to do a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
He's compared this to people's reports about their friends, to physiological measures. Ultimately, you are the best expert on whether or not you're happy.
Mm-hmm.
So even though self-reports have a lot of problems with them, it turns out in this field, they work pretty well.
All right. Well, let's transition a little bit. We're going to keep coming back to happiness, but as you mentioned, then it's very fair that the book is, in lots of ways, more than just the title. You started off with 12 truths. You end up with 10 truths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about your concept of elevation,
mm-hmm.
An interesting concept of the ethic of divinity. What is the ethic of divinity? How does that fit into you? It's a heady phrase, but it's a very interesting concept behind it.
Yeah. Well, I got the phrase from my postdoc advisor at the University of Chicago, Richard Schwader, who does research in India. And when I worked with Schwader, I spent some time in India and read a lot about Hinduism. And I've always been fascinated. I study morality. I guess that hasn't come up yet. But my research at UVA is on morality and the moral mm-hmm. emotions. And for Westerners, this is mostly meant, well, morality, that's like, you know, helping strangers who are suffering. That's like not lying and hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of the world, morality is about a lot more than that. Morality is about loyalty to the group, and it's about respecting your authorities, and it's about living a life of piety and purity. And, you know, for those of us, especially who are sort of modern secular, you know, liberal Democrat types, especially, we have a very particular notion of morality, which is about helping victims and leaving people free to pursue their goals. For most of the world, morality is really much more about sort of the thickness of the society or the hive, I even say. I mean, society, you know, societies are in some sense like beehives. And so, for those of us who live in a sort of a thinner moral world, you know, where we're really trying to leave people free to do what they want, we look on these ideas, you know, that the religious right has about, oh, well, you know, we need to have, you know, prayer in school and respect for the flag and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks like repressive superstition and we don't really understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I learned from Schwader and what I learned in India is that there is a kind of a vertical dimension in our minds which runs, there's no better way to say it, from God above to the devil below.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm an atheist. I don't believe that God or the devil exists, but I have experiences of being lifted up or pushed down. When I see something sort of sleazy and horrible, I feel degraded,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, degraded, brought down. So I've been doing research on this emotion, which I call elevations. I presume that's why you opened with that U2 clip.
That's correct.
Okay, and what I'm finding is that whether or not you're religious, we all have this ability to feel raised up or brought down. And Thomas Jefferson, I got the word elevation from Jefferson, actually.
Right.
He wrote about it.
Right. Well done, UVA professor. A little Jefferson there. And let's talk a little bit about that in just a few minutes, because I want to talk about your concept of flatland and the culture war. We've been talking a lot about, and you've shared with us some great information from science and positive psychology. What did the ancients actually have to tell us about happiness, about mm-hmm. morality, mm-hmm. about virtue? What jumped out to you and said, you know, it's not enough to focus on positive psychology in the 90s moving forward and all of our scientific knowledge. There really is wonderful insight from the ancients. How do you distill that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the ancients, were they good psychologists? Well, the stuff that comes down to us, you have to realize, is only the stuff that somebody thought worth copying down or passing on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this great filtering process whereby the words we get from Buddha and Jesus and Marcus Aurelius, well, you know, okay, the Romans wrote books and we still have their books, but from the real ancient sources, what really gets passed down is the stuff that spoke to people through the ages. So a lot of it has this real resonance of truth. Another thing that's really striking to me about the wisdom of the ancients is that it's pretty conservative. That is, they weren't out there saying, go express yourself, young man. They were saying, honor your mother and father, respect God, mm-hmm. restrain your passions, control yourself, develop discipline, all that sort of stuff. And there is a lot of wisdom in that. And, you know, especially I'm a liberal secular atheist, recognizing the wisdom of binding yourself in, of limiting your options, limiting your freedom, committing to things larger than yourself. You know, it's kind of hard to take this if it's being lectured, if you're being lectured at by, you know, your priest or rabbi or something. But
mm-hmm.
I ended up just finding that there is a lot of wisdom in this, in some of these conservative ideas from the
All
ancients.
Right. And we'll go back in just a second to what they didn't know. We actually have a call, Sue, from Springfield. Sue, are you there?
Hi, this is Sue Tillotson.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine.
Oh, hello, Sue. Good. How are you?
Go ahead.
What I want to ask Jonathan is, the experience of having someone who knows very well about others. Oh, I didn't realize I'd be on air.
You are on the air.
On the air, okay. There are people who are naturally happy and who live out a moral life despite any kind of association with any kind of religion. And yet there are those who work overtime, it seems like, to denigrate that good life. And my experience with this kind of comes full circle to what Jonathan was saying about that how to reframe. And my experience is that those people who are able to reframe in the moment have a special gift regarding uplifting others. Could he comment on that kind of connection to what he's saying between morality and the actions that you can take to actually lift your own happiness level?
Well, hi, Sue. Well, there was a few different questions in there. With regard to some people's ability to reframe, happy people and optimists are particularly good at that. So if you're saying that people who can do that also tend to lift others up, you know, there are people who, when they walk into the room, they really light up the room. And you know, those tend to be people who are just born with, brains set for happiness and seeing opportunities and possibilities in the world. So I think there is something to your observation there. Your opening observation that about the rather tenuous connection between actually being religious and behaving morally, I think, is absolutely correct. Atheists don't behave any worse than religious people. And of course, religion has been an aid to all kinds of horrible events throughout history. I'm just beginning to explore the ways that religion, that there are different ways of participating in religion. And for those who are really sincere at it and are in a healthy religious community.
If you would like to make a comment.
Okay, well, I guess we lost her.
I'm sure she's still listening, though.
Oh, okay. Okay. But anyway, yeah, there is a lot of research on the relationship between religion and morality. And, you know, people who just, you know, go to church regularly and are not devout believers aren't, a lot of their motives are largely social, and we can catch them in all kinds of hypocrisies. And it's not too hard to do that.
You're listening to The Wake Up Call on WNRN. We'll be right back with more from Professor Haidt.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
This weekend, The Hook at UVA, the student-run Cavalier Daily Newspaper, has filed suit against Virginia ABC law that prohibits ads for alcohol in college papers. Speaking of newspapers, The Hook explores the new Crozet Gazette and discusses with editor Mike Marshall his plan for the Western Albemarle region's new monthly, and The Brazen Careerist offers up 7 strategies for getting a new job. Speaking of happiness, all that and more this week in The Hook. Today's programming on WNRN is brought to you by Five Guys Burgers and Fries, Seville Reader's Choice for Burgers, and rated by Zagat Restaurant Survey for 4 years running. Five Guys serves America's standard, fresh, and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and open until 10 Friday and Saturday. Five Guys Burgers and Fries is behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center and is now open in the Hollymead Town Center and on the downtown mall, Charlottesville, 975 Guys. And support for NRN today is also coming from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, featuring a wide selection of camping and backpacking gear. Blue Ridge is also your headquarters for outdoor footwear, from Teva and Reef sandals to Merrell, Montrail, and the North Face hiking boots. The experts at Blue Ridge can help you get the most out of your summer outdoors. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville, the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen in Richmond, and at BRMS.com. And at noon today, join George Bell for Les Temps Purdue. If French isn't your thing, that means the time's gone by. And on WNRN, that means late 80s through mid-90s alternative. Tune in for it next at noon. That's Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. You're listening to The Wake Up Call on WNRN. If you'd like to give a call and ask a question about happiness, morality, virtue, and the meaning of life and in life, which we're about to get to, give us a call, 979-0919 or 1-877-967-6762. In the book, John, I wouldn't say that you punt on the meaning of life, but you mentioned that is the question that so many people want answers to, the meaning of life. But you shift gears and make a distinction between that and what you consider maybe equally important or perhaps more important, which is meaning in life. What is that all about?
I think it's a little clear if you talk about the purpose of life. A lot of people want to know what's the purpose of life? What's the meaning of life? By which they mean, why are we here? Why were we put here? And, that's something. I mean, look, I'm an atheist. I believe in evolution. I think that we weren't put here for any purpose whatsoever. It's all a gigantic fluke.
That's its own show. That's its own show, by the way. But it is an interesting question. Maybe just for a second, you're exposed through your research to a huge amount of religious tradition. Mm-hmm. And you evidence throughout the book real respect for
yes.
for religion and the power it has to excuse me help people with their own sort of happiness quotient. How do you end up still being atheist despite that? That's an interesting paradox.
Because in the course of studying morality, in the course of working in India, in the course of doing research for this book, I came to realize that religions embody a great deal of wisdom about human flourishing and well-being. Now, they based those claims on a claim which I think is false, which is that God exists and created us. But they have a kind of wisdom that I do not find in science and scientists more generally. So I have gained a lot of respect because I've learned from them, and I respect anybody who teaches me anything. But it hasn't changed my factual beliefs about whether or not we were created for some purpose. Now, so back to the issue of the meaning of...
Yeah, I don't want to put you on the spot, but it is interesting, given the full trajectory of the book.
Yeah.
Purpose of life, purpose within life.
Yeah, so there's this really funny, you know, one of my favorite movies is Monty Python's Monty Python and the Meaning of Life. And
shocking.
In the movie, it started out saying, well, what's the meaning of life? And they go through, there's this wonderful skit where this... waiter is guiding this couple through philosophy, discussion. And the discussion seems to be all about why were we put here. But then at the end of the movie, one of the actors gets a card with the answer on it. What's the meaning of life? And the meaning of life is treat each other well, don't eat too many fats or sweets, take a walk every now and then. All right, so that's two very different questions. The first is why were we put here? The second is how should I live?
Uh-huh.
And the question of why we were put here, that's the one that I punt on, because, I don't think we were put here for anything. The question of how we should live, boy, that's a great question. And that's actually a question you should ask a psychologist, not just a theologian or a philosopher, because this is really an empirical question. What are the conditions that lead to human flourishing and well-being?
Right, and so much of really what the book keeps coming back to is we know objectively through rigorous research what conditions, things that you can do to give yourself a better sense of purpose within your life.
That's right. And most of that and the stuff you'll find in other books on happiness is all about you. What you can do to make yourself happier. And there's this, this book a lot of listeners may have heard of called The Purpose-Driven Life. It was the biggest selling book a couple years ago. It's the, Christian book on how
huge,
to find...
Huge, yeah, millions of copies.
Right, tens of millions of copies all around the world. The opening line of that book is brilliant, and it really got me. And I read it for research for this book. The opening line is, it's not all about you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really one of the fundamental lessons of religion.
Caller, we know you're there. Just hang on.
That the pursuit of individual happiness paradoxically undercuts your ability to be happy because we are a fundamentally ultra-social species. We have to find meaning by binding ourselves into others and other projects. So that's what religion is so good at, is taking our emphasis off ourselves, stop focusing on your petty, insignificant self, and think about something else.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the hive and connectedness and the between that you talk about. Caller, are you there? Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to state that I go to Unitarian Universalist Church, and that's for a lot of people out there that are really confused about, the meaning of life and about deities and whatnot. It's a really good place. It's very open, and, they're evolutionists and people that are into, Eastern religions, and there's all kinds of people there. And it's just a really good place for people that are questioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Waynesboro, but they're all over the place. And I just think that's a really good thing to have because it's not like a traditional church at all.
Right, and I agree. I think
thanks for the call, too. Go ahead, John.
I think the Christian left is really onto something. It's unfortunate that the Christian left is so small in this country compared to the Christian right. But on the Christian left, I think you have people who basically endorse many of the good things about liberalism and tolerance and pluralism and respect for people, and yet who bring in a lot of the enrichment that religion can give. Now the Christian right is able to create a much sort of thicker hive, which is satisfying to some people, but then leads to all kinds of problems in a diverse society such as ours.
So you emphasize a lot this the issue of, talk about some fascinating concepts of coherence and vital engagements. I didn't want to talk about work, but you notice that we're dualistic. We're shaped to be competitive individuals, mm-hmm. and we're hive creatures. And you flirt with politics and American society a little bit in the book. And I think you try to lay out that Republicans, for example, or conservatives who have been in the ascendancy, maybe do a better job of speaking to this pursuit of happiness. How do you make that connection?
Yeah. So, you know, for the most part, if you have just one principle to explain all of human nature, then sure, go ahead and say people are selfish and that they'll vote for whoever gives them, you know, money or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what economists do. They say, let's try to explain as much as we can by the idea that people are just pursuing their self-interest. But you don't have to use just one principle. There's a lot more to human nature. And I think that human nature was shaped in part by a process called group selection. It's a little controversial. But the idea that over last 100,000 years, we've evolved to be able to merge into a larger group to then compete with other groups. And we lived in tribal societies for a long time. But I think some of our ultra-sociality, our ability to perform extreme acts of altruism and self-sacrifice comes from this last 100,000 years of group selection. Now, given that, if we really did evolve to live in these tight tribal sorts of groups, but we now live in this open, modern, free society where you can just pick up and leave whenever you want, what that means is that we're not living in the way that our brains were designed for. There's no reason morally why we have to do that, but the point is that we're at a loss sometimes. We feel it's as though we have certain needs that can't be satisfied. And that's the hunger that you see in a lot of American society, in portraits of American society. You know, you just showed me a paper, an article from the Washington Post this morning about Americans are spending more time alone and feeling more alienated.
It is social isolation growing in the U.S.,
exactly.
The study says.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the studies generally say that it is. You know, the bowling alone phenomenon. No, you know,
people Robert
don't
Putnam.
Join leagues anymore. So, you know, this is, again, where the wisdom of religion comes in, that people don't just vote for the person who's going to give them money. And this is what the Democrats don't get. I think that Al Gore and John Kerry both honestly believed that people were going to vote for them if they promised them policies. But that's not what voting's about. People want to live in a moral nation. They want to they want a leader that they can look up to. Now, I don't quite see how they were able to believe that about what's his name, our current guy. But
what is the message that, for example, Karl Rove and other Republican strategists, what is the message that they get right that in your mind liberals today don't get right, and they keep getting hammered?
Need to thicken up society. We should not just try to give people as much freedom as possible. In the 1950s and 60s, this country was full of injustice, and people who came of age in that generation, including John Kerry, fought the good fight to bring freedom to African Americans, to women, and came to think, I think, that the more we can push freedom and independence and rights for people, the better. But, you know, the last chapter of my book is about yin and yang and balance. That can go too far. And when that goes too far, you end up with a society where everybody's got rights, but nobody's got duties or responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
You end up with a very thin society, like a billiard table where balls can just, you know, bounce around as they please. And that is deeply unsatisfying. So all this nonsense about, oh, let's amend the Constitution to protect the flag. Well, obviously it's nonsense, but it speaks to many people's need to hold something sacred.
So talking a lot about community as much as anything
else. That's right. People need to believe that they live in a moral community where people care about the group and the nation. They care, you know, respect rules and laws, and they're very threatened by you know, portrayals that they see on the media and of a society sort of being lost in chaos and moral disorder. So I think this is part of what the Republicans speak to, is the need for law and order, respect for God and country and family. This is what family values is all about. It's not really about policies that will help families. It's about an ordered, you know, hierarchical family.
It's a sense of connectedness. You also have to wake up call 979-0919 or 1-877-967-6762 if you have a question about happiness, connectedness, community, wide range of fascinating issues that we have an opportunity to discuss this morning with Professor Jonathan Haidt from UVA. And in a way, when I read this, it seemed to kind of turn the common wisdom about our two political parties on its head. Because in a way, we often thumbnail the GOP as about individual rights. Right? It's about me me as an individual. Get big government out of my life. And Democrats can be viewed as collectivists. But you're kind of turning that on its head and looking at sort of a deeper resonance.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that there are several kinds of liberals and several kinds of conservatives.
Sure.
So, you know,
it's not a monolith on either side.
And the Republicans, you know, the coalition's beginning to come apart a bit because you've got the more libertarian types who say get government off our back. And then you've got the Christian right type, which says let's use government to enforce a thicker Christian moral world. And that coalition, you know, got them all into office. But now there are quite a few quite a few cracks in it. On the left, Democrats and liberals are sometimes seen as collectivists because they care about the welfare of the community. But what you have to realize is that on the left, it's a community composed of individuals. And it's a real focus, I would say even a fetish, on victims. I think
so the politics of victimhood, which is taking civil rights, women's issues, get to an extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they aren't important, but they're...
Well, that's right. But it becomes a fetish because it means you can't ever criticize. You can't ever be seen to blame a victim. And, you know, I started watching Fox News and reading the new,
Weekly Standard, National Review.
Yeah. Just, you know, because I need to understand how conservatives think. And boy, they have so much fun lampooning the absurdities that the left gets itself into because of the things it can't say because of political correctness.
Sure. Sure. So, and interesting, this foundation on community. I want to come back to the issue of balance, but before that, you do talk about, and this matters to everybody listening, the importance of work in happiness, mm-hmm. and vocation. Talk about a little bit about why that's important and how then we can get more satisfaction from work, whatever it is that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the ultimate truth of the book is that happiness comes from between. It's not just something you find inside. It's not just something you get from getting, money or something else outside.
And if I can jump in, I think that's an important part, because if you read just the first half of the book, which I didn't do, I read more than that, but you could come away thinking that, well, all he's saying is that I'm in control of my own destiny. If I just get inside my own head and work things out, then I'll be happy. But it's not that.
Mm-hmm,
there's an important second part.
Mm-hmm, that's right. In the way that sharks have to keep swimming to keep breathing, mm-hmm. We have to keep doing and striving. We have to have goals. If you give up your goals, it's not like you're going to die, but you'll certainly not be flourishing. And this is the problem when people win the lottery and they quit their jobs and don't have anything to take its place. We can't be happy with a life of just consumption. We need to be striving for things and making progress. Happiness comes more from making progress towards goals than it does from achieving goals. We actually, when we achieve a goal, we actually tend to be happy for minutes or hours, not days.
Mm-hmm.
The happiness comes from the progress.
And there's research to back this up as well.
Yes, that's right. We get little bursts of pleasure from each step we take towards our goal. When you achieve a goal, it actually is more of a release. What's happening in the brain is that the goal-seeking parts on the left frontal cortex that were really focused, they relax. And that feels good, but it's more the good of like taking off your ice skates when they were too tight. It doesn't last very long. In our modern society, work is a major source of identity. In older times, it wasn't, and people got more spent a lot, much more time in family, let's say.
And we spend a huge amount of time at work.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Well, here we are on a Sunday. For us in modern America, work is one of the major things that we do. And the discovery in positive psychology is that by knowing your strengths, you can then both figure out whether the kind of work you've got matches those strengths. But even if it doesn't, you can find ways of making it. You can find ways of recasting your work, of using your strengths so that you get to really employ them at the workplace.
Even if it's a job that you consider kind of dead end, mm-hmm.
sort of
numbing at some level, and you're sort of a work to live person. It's a means mm-hmm. to an end.
That's
there are
right.
things you can do to take more out of that. Mm-hmm. What would
that's
those
right.
be?
So the distinction is made in the research literature is between work as a job, a career, and a calling.
Okay.
And people who have work as a job, they're just doing it for the paycheck, and that's it. And people who have it as a calling, they do it if they didn't get paid because they love doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
the mission side of it.
That's right. And the interesting thing is that one of the women who did this work, Amy Riznewski, she did this a study in a hospital. Now, hospitals got all kinds of people. And you might think, well, the doctors, they have a calling. The orderlies, the janitors, they just have a job. But what she found was that in every job, there were people who saw it in all three ways. So you had plenty of doctors who were just in it, especially as a career. The doctors were very career striving. But she found orderlies who they said, my job isn't to clean up vomit. My job is to help heal people. And
I'm part of a community.
That
sort of comes back to what you're talking about before.
Exactly. That's right. Part of a community with a noble purpose. And they would bring flowers on their own. They would find flowers to bring into a patient's room for a patient in a coma, thinking, well, when she wakes up, I want her to see something pretty. So there are ways of approaching work, recasting it, changing, reframing. What do you think you're doing here? That can get you much more engaged.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. We're listening to Jonathan Haidt talk about happiness hypothesis, WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. You close with a discussion of balance. Is that a new concept, or is this, again, something that the ancients have been telling us? I mean, some would argue that, you know, everything is a footnote since Plato and, and all these thinkers. What in particular stands out to you about balance, and how do I, as an individual or individual listeners, usefully apply that concept in their lives?
Yeah. You know, everyone's heard that you know, the importance of balance, and you can sort of nod at it intellectually. But what I really learned in doing the book, you know, I gained a lot more respect for conservatives and for religious people. And I realized that you really do need both. If America was completely controlled by liberals, you would have all kinds of excesses that, and some of which we saw in some social policies. And if it was completely controlled by conservatives, as it is now, you have an opposite set of problems. In a way, you really need both to have a healthy country. This is just part of the essence of morality, is that our minds are made to divide the world into good and evil. And we do that so thoroughly that it's then impossible to credit the other side. But in doing this research on morality, I've come to at least see that there is wisdom on both sides.
Great. We've been listening to and having a conversation with Professor Jonathan Haidt from UVA. He is the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, Why the Meaningful Life is Closer Than You Think. John, thanks very much for coming in. One last word?
Yes, one last word.
Go ahead, please.
If people want more information on positive psychology, they can go to www.authentichappiness.org, which is Martin Seligman's site where people can find out what their strengths are.
And you have a site, too.
That's right. My site is www.happinesshypothesis.com, where you can read some chapters of the book and find some other materials on it.
Super. Thanks very much. Very much enjoyed it. Rick will be back next week. I'm Pete Ronayne. Thanks for listening in.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Catherine Greiner. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.